Afternoon. I think this morning Rob did a very good job for all of us, and he laid down a program of polymer physics in biology, which will keep us busy for the next 5-10 years. Plenty of problems to work on. I think the best thing he did was to give us the Hamiltonian, so we can really just not forget about the biology and. Okay, the problem I will talk about in the first 20 minutes of the discussion is actually one of the simplest problems in this category. The problem actually has a long history, ever since the late 50s and 60s. There are a lot of good people who work on this problem, and I think there were a lot of good progress towards the end of the 1960s. So to a large extent, at least in terms of comparing the theory with the experiment, the foundations on this research on this topic has more or less been completed, I would say. But there were a few problems, sort of dangling issues, which lasted till very recently. Because of the time, I'm not going to go through all of the history of the problem. For those of you who are interested learning what people have done, a lot of good people who they did very good work. So you can find this information from the book by Colin Shiraga, which is also seems to be relevant for coding voting. And then there's a very nice review article on this topic, published in 1985, for this report. There are also two very nice websites that people actually wrote programs. So if you're interested in looking at the melting curve of a particular DNA sequence, you can just download their program, feed in the sequence, out come the melting curve in a matter of seconds. Okay, so basically, I think from the point of view of biology, at least in their field, the problem is considered to be solved. So basically, there's not much to be done. But anyway, I still can tell you some of the dangling issues, especially concerning how to do the statistical mechanics with sequence information. And in fact, if you think about the methods we have in statistical mechanics, there are some methods for treating disorder systems, but this is always a very sticky issue, how to do the statistical mechanics in the correct way. So some of the pathologies for this problem may be relevant to more complicated problems, like RNA coding and then protein coding. Maybe I just quickly remind you what happens experimentally for this transition. You know that the native structure of the DNA is the double helix. So, but if you heat it up to about 80, 85 degrees, then the two chains is going to opening up into two single chains, which are in sort of a coil state. In fact, you can try to reverse the process by decreasing the temperature. And normally you cannot completely recover the original helix. So I think the reason is to find, because these chains are usually very long. And the two chains, although they are complementary, but really to find the perfect match back to the original state is not always kinetically possible. The way people experimentally study this transition is by monitoring the ultraviolet light absorption onto the. So usually when they do the experiment, they first have to purify. They just isolate a particular kind of DNA and then put them in a solution, in a very dilute form. And then they shine the ultraviolet light, and then they can monitor the absorbance of the solution. And depending on the structure of these DNA molecules, if they are in a helical form, then the absorption is less. When the chain opened up, then it's about 40% enhancement per base pair. So using this technique, you can very nicely monitor the transition.
Is it known where What kind of a transition is this?
So this is what I'm trying to tell you. So experimentally, you can do this for short chains, for long chains. Okay, so I'm going to show you some results.
I'm sorry, I meant the optical transition, this absorption.
This has to do with the chemistry. When you shine the light, then there's some photoelectric processes which depend on whether these acid bases, they are in the double helix, hidden inside the double helix, or in the solution, then the light absorption is different.
The loss of the stacking of the So in other words, you have less absorbance when bases are stacked on top of each other. Because of the separation of electrons between the bases.
Yes. So if you make a dipole on one base, it's clean on the other base.
Okay. Well, anyway, so typically, experimentally, you can measure the absorbance as a function of temperature and take the derivative with to temperature. And this is a so-called melting curve for a particular DNA molecule which has 4,662 base pairs, not very long. And so as you increase the temperature, you see that the way the chain melts is not that it happens at a single temperature, but it melts in stages. So each peak actually corresponds to a particular segment on the chain that this helix opens up into a loop structure. And you can see that for this particular DNA, you have like 13 distinct segments that melt.
How big was that
DNA? It's 4,662 base pairs. And the width of each peak is something of the order of 0.5 degrees. So each peak is quite narrow. But the whole melting transition region spans over a range of 10 or 15 degrees.
Because of heterogeneity.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, you can trace this the position of the peaks into to the local GC or AT concentration. So, but then the question is why, even though it's a heterogeneous chain, why does it melt in this particular well-defined segment? So this will be an interesting question to ask. So what will happen if you study a much longer chain, like an E. coli, which has 4.6 million base pairs? What would you guess? Will you still see individual peaks, or see more continuous curve? Okay. In fact, you see a continuous curve, which is actually quite easy to understand because each of the peaks I showed you has a width of, say, 0.5 degrees, and a chain of 4,600 base pairs will have 13 peaks. So if you have a few million base pairs, then there will be lots and lots of these peaks, and they will all overlap each other. And this way, you get a continuous curve. So this is indeed what people observe experimentally. Here, there are actually two curves, the solid line and the dotted line. The solid line is from the experiment, and the dotted line is actually the result of a computer program with parameters which I talked a little bit about, which fits quite well the experimental measurement. So that means, in terms of the modeling, we can come quite close, at least for the thermodynamic data, quite close to actual behavior. You can take even longer chance in the human DNA, and then the melting curve has a somewhat different shape. It's quite interesting.
Are you going to explain why?
Yeah, I don't have 20 minutes, so I've already spent 10 minutes. But anyway, I try to hint some of the reasons behind this. So here is a quick summary of what I told you. If you start with studying a really short chain, say a 300 base pairs or less, then in fact you only observe a single well-defined melting transition. And the peak would be maybe half a degree or something, the peak width. But the position of the peak, the melting temperature, is basically a function of the G and C concentration in the chain. So there's a very good formula that fits the experimental data very well. Of course, the formula will depend on the salt concentration in the solution. If you have medium-sized chain, and I showed you the graph, then you have a few to 10 or 15 well-resolved peaks. And if you have a much longer chain, then you have just a single continuous melting curve. So what sort of theoretical issues we would like to focus on? One is, why is the melting of individual domains so sharp? So I give you some idea, but tomorrow we have a longer discussion on this, I believe. So the melting of individual domains, each of 300 base pairs, this transition is like a first order transition. Yeah?
I'm sorry, I just missed the peaks that you showed. That was a derivative of the absorbance curve?
Yeah, yeah. And then if you have a very long chain, can you say anything about it in the, you know, thermodynamic limit?
Excuse me, what do you mean when you say about first order phase transition? In our system, there are no first order phase
transition. Well, not if you have some sort of a modified Ising model, which I tell you just now.
You mean a logarithmic free energy of loop or something like that?
Well, usually in a transition, a true thermodynamic transition is defined that if you go to the infinite size limit, then if you look at things like the free energy, you would have a singularity at some temperature. So this can happen even for one-dimensional chain, provided you have the interaction which I'll describe.
Okay.
So, in fact, it's a very good model for us to do statistical mechanics, which can also, basically this computer curve I showed you, basically it comes from this kind of model. In fact, Ralph already told us about the model. It's called a pair stacking model. So you start with a double strand DNA molecule, and then you can go along, you can number the bases, of course, and then for each base, and then there are basically two states, in the helical structure or in the coil part. So this can very well be described by an Ising variable for each base. And then, so it's basically some sort of an Ising model, but of course you have to define the Hamiltonian. Now, when these bases, they are in the helical form, then of course we have these stacking energies Ralph talked about. So this then translates into some statistical weights for the paired bases. But these weights, the thing is, because it's a heterogeneous chain, so these weights for different bases can vary. So in fact, if you think in terms of the Ising model, this corresponds to a random field. Okay. Because here you have spin up, say, here spin down. But the precise energy for the spin up state depends on what kind of base you have. So if you have a field that varies from side to side, this will be the case. Then the difference from the usual one-dimensional Ising model is the way you assign to an open loop, which is like a spin down domain. Okay. Normally for the spin down domain, of course when you create a spin down domain, you have to pay the domain wall energy, which is just the exchange coupling. But then there are also some energy for the down spins. Now to model the loop, because you are really looking at the loop in a solution. So to model the statistical weight for the loop correctly, then you have to, in addition to these domain wall energies, you have to put in a statistical factor coming from the entropy of the loops, which depends on the length of the loop. So in this particular case, this loop has three bases. So it will, the weight for this opening part will be some sigma times this function at L equal to 3. This sigma term is called loop initiation factor. It's in fact very, very important. And I, in the biochemistry, or in the biophysics, chemical physics, maybe, I don't know, usually they assign the number 10 to the minus 5 to the loop initiation factor. And this is a very small number. It has a very important effect. It suppresses loops of very small size. So imagine you just want to have a loop of a few base pairs, then the penalty is huge if you accept this number. Okay. And what this does is that even when you are close to the transition, you will not see loops very often, loops of very small size. Either you, if you have, a, of course, a loop of very large size, then you can gain some other kind of configurational entropy. But a loop of very small size is not very likely. And this has the effect of narrowing down the transition tremendously, as I explained. Okay, now I think Rob also explained you this factor, this function f, how does it depend on the length of the loop? And usually it goes as a power law of the length with an exponent. And the exponent will depend on some details of how you model the free loop.
Isn't it log?
Hmm?
Log
was
limited.
Well, if you take a logarithm, it becomes a log. No, this is just a bare.
It's the number of states.
Oh, this is the entropy. No, it's not the entropy.
It's the number of states.
No, wait. So beta is no. Beta is 1.6 times temperature.
Beta is depends on. Say if you have three walks usually the value people take is for the self-avoiding walk in the physical dimension, then beta will be like 1.76. But then if you include like loop-loop interactions, which we'll hear about tomorrow, then beta can go up to above 2. And 2 is a magic number. I'll explain why.
The stacking energy is not picking the number. The Wi is defined for each site, mm-hmm. each pair, right?
Well, we can make it depend on the pair. Yeah, you can basically, it turns out that this differentiation, although it's very important from the point of view of chemistry, because of the, that you actually, you never really have an open up loop of a few base pairs. So it doesn't really matter whether you attribute the weight. If you say the stacking energy, then you can say the weights are on the bounds, these kind of bounds, these pairs, pairwise, okay, instead of on the sides. But anyway, this fine differentiation, where if you don't worry about bubbles or loops of very small size, then basically it averages out. Okay, so it's not too important. Because in the end, when you do the partition function, you take the product of these weights. Okay? And if you never encounter terms, or only one or two of these terms, if you always see a product of 10 or more, then you can have the freedom to shift the weight either to the bound or to the side. Okay? So it doesn't matter too much. Yeah?
But the W is essentially called the sequence, right?
W is the, yeah. If you give me the sequence, then you see there will be a sequence of the values.
So there are a few values, but it's not like a continuous random variable or something like that.
They are not continuous. Usually just say two or actually, if you ask the biologist, then they give you two like this, from which the value of the W's can be extracted. But it's a little bit complicated. But in fact, they are not too complicated. You can do pretty well in even in a quantitative thing, modeling the experimental curves by just choosing two different values, and that's usually enough. But if you want to be more precise, then you have to understand the table and so on. But what is important, one quantity which is very important, is the helix to the entropy change for the helix to coil transition. And if you believe the numbers they put down here, then you have something like 12.5 kV per base pair. I don't know whether this is considered to be a reasonable number or not, but this is the number they assume. And with this number, then you can fit the width of individual peaks for a domain of 100 or 200 base pairs. So the width of these peaks depend on this number. And once you have this number, the other numbers, if you know the melting temperature as a function of composition, then the other numbers basically follow. Okay, so this is, in fact, the number you need to put in, plus the loop initiation factor. Okay, so we've got the model, and the rest we can just go back and try to calculate the Hartree function and solve the problem. In fact, it's not too difficult. It's just one-dimensional eigenmodel. What it cannot be simpler than this. But in fact, there's some tricky parts in this problem, many people have stressed through the solution over the years, and I'm not going to go through the details of the calculation. You can do a really honest job. You don't have to cheat, and you can get pretty far without cheating. But I will cheat.
Can I ask you a question? If you just so had the poly A or poly G, all completely ordered, then you would have been in this transition curves, melting curves, one peak which is so sharp, half a degree. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
You have a homo.
Yeah.
This is what I'm coming to. So we start with the simple problem of a homo polymer unbinding. This problem can be solved exactly. But as I said, I want to cheat, so I'm not going to solve it exactly, but just to give you some ideas how you can get the result. The result is in fact quite unexpected, and I'll explain. Okay. So in this case, the weights for all the helical the pair bases are the same, so we don't distinguish them. And basically, to understand the nature of the transition, we can consider the excess free energy of loop compared to a helical segment. Okay. And this, in fact, you can easily write down. So basically, you can just write down the weight for the loop and take the logarithm, and that gives you, in this case, the Gibbs free energy over KVT. And then you compare this with the case when this segment is in the helical form. Okay. So in the helical form, you will have W to the power L. We take the logarithm to come L times log W. So this term is the temperature dependent. Now, I'm putting an extra factor here, 2 times log L. Where does this come from? This comes from the feeder for the two ends. When you make a bubble, okay, but the ends of the bubble is homogeneous, okay? So the ends of the bubble can take many different positions. So in fact, if you have a loop of length L, the number of positions available for the two ends, for each of them is order L. So together L squared, okay? So you get extra minus 2 log L, which is very important. And we said that this function F of L is a function of, it's a power law function, you take the logarithm. So it has an exponent beta. So you have basically three terms. First term is 2 minus beta log L. And then you have this loop initiation factor coming in, and then you have this term that depends on temperature. Okay. Yeah.
Could you explain the two? Why is it not 3/2 of the loop return probe width?
It's beta. It's in the beta.
So why is it different from just the probe width to make a return?
No, it's not. It's in the beta. Beta is, for example, 3/2. But on top of that. So this is just when you fix the end, yeah. And you say, what's the probability of coming back after L steps? exactly L steps. That will be L to the power of minus theta. Okay. But when you do the loop, you have to consider the different possibilities for the two ends. Then you get this 2 log L term. Okay. Then you see immediately that.
What's the second the second logarithm?
Yes.
2 logarithm L, yes.
This is because when you have you consider a loop of size L, okay, in this particular sort of vague defined region of size L, 2L over the matter. But the loop, when you sum up the partition function, you have to consider different conditions.
Of that.
Yeah, yeah. So you see immediately that when beta is greater, depending on beta bigger or less than 2, you get different conclusions. If beta is greater than 2, then the coefficient of the logarithm, the whole thing is positive. Okay, so this means large loops are unfavorable, and this will lead to a first order transition. And this is indeed what you find if you do everything exactly. If beta is less than 2, then this term has a negative coefficient in front, then loops of sufficiently large size, they are excited at the transition point where delta t is 0. Okay, then you will have a continuous transition.
Excuse me again for this 2 log L.
Yeah.
I don't understand the 2 because I would think that if you choose the origin of your loop, you choose the length L.
Yeah.
So you have only 1 log L for choosing the origin of the loop, and then you have the entropy of the term.
So if you fix both ends, if you fix both ends, the probability of coming back is L to the minus beta. And beta is, say, 3/2 or 1.75, depending on who you ask. Okay? Now, but now I'm doing the Cartesian function for this segment with the loop, which I say of order L. The size is order L. Okay? So then I have to consider all different possibilities for the two ends.
Why dependency? Because you have fixed L or
less? No, you have to do this. You have to sum over all loop configurations.
Right? Yeah,
but
of
length L.
Of length L, but each end has...
But the
physical
position of the two
ends.
No, but there is only one.
No, each end has...
L is L. The confusion is that you really want to sum over L. Yeah. It's really considering all sides of the loop.
Right.
You use a short term.
Well, actually, I've not seen this argument in any paper, but I find it really the nice argument. That's why I'm telling you.
Give you the right result.
Yeah.
But you know, if beta is less than 1, you don't have a transition at all. Can you see that from here?
No, beta equal to 1. In fact, you
less
have difficulty
one.
Less than 1. In fact, you will never have because it's you will run into serious difficulty. But anyway, that's a separate issue.
But you can't see this from this argument.
Not from this argument. There's nothing magic.
But this is part of this
potential. But the return, this part will kill you, because the return, if the return is L to the power minus less than 1, then when you integrate, this is the first return. Okay? Mm-hmm. Then if you have a beta less than 1, if there's a first return probability, it cannot be less than 1. Okay. Because less, if this... This probability is the first return probability after minus L. Then if beta is less than 1, you're in trouble.
It's always
wrong.
It's always wrong. Yeah, so there's no
there
transition.
There is no transition.
It's down.
No, I mean, you can do the sum back with such a beta, but in terms of the original problem.
But your argument.
Don't put the wall.
No, and this is not part of my argument. It's just that. Beta, it doesn't happen. That's my point. Okay. But okay, you may want to look at what happens to my argument
right.
In that case which I've not thought about, but we can talk about it later. Okay. But the magic part is this sigma term, which I told you. Okay, so you can from this kind of expression you can also estimate the width of the transition region. In this case, when beta is less than 2, we know it's a continuous transition. But how sharp is the transition when we have this loop initiation factor? Okay. And basically, what you do is you can get a length scale by equating think this plus this term are equal to KBT or something like that. Then you get, okay, so basically 1 divided by KBT. So sigma times L to the power 2 minus beta equal to 1. Then you get a minimum loop size, which goes as this loop initiation factor to the power minus 1 over 2 minus beta. And if you take the self-avoiding log result for the value of beta, then you can sigma equal to 10 to the minus 5, people use in biology, then you get something like 10 to the 20 base pairs for the minimum loop size. Even though it's a continuous transition, okay? But it looks as if it's extremely sharp. So the width you estimate, so the width will basically go as the melting temperature over this lens, which will go as, so the width is 10 to the minus 19 Kelvin. Of course, this is not what we observe. You have to put in the randomness. So we come to the heteropolymer combining. Now again, in this case, I will start with a simpler situation. You have these weights which depend on where you are on the plane. But first, let's look at what happens if we set this function to be a constant. When we set the function to be a constant, it becomes exactly the one-dimensional random field Ising model. And there's an exact solution by these two gentlemen in 1968. In fact, it's not as trivial as I thought in the beginning. I dig it out yesterday night. But in fact, there's no analytic expression. You have to solve some sort of a self-consistent functional equation to get a number. But anyway, that's something you can easily do on a computer. So basically, there's an exact solution. But I'm not going to tell you an exact solution, just tell you some heuristics. So again, you can use the same kind of...
What do you mean by exact solution here?
But it's the Ising model. If you said
what do you mean by exact distribution?
You get, say, the free energy, you get the...
You
get everything.
Exact solutions, analytically exact solutions. I think the first one was by Brinsmann et al. In the 80s. And it depends on the distribution of your field. They did it for a binary distribution. And in the 80s, in the 90s, there was solution, exact solution by Theo Neumann-Roizen for exponentially decaying solutions of random fields. No, but he says that he doesn't solve. He solves them. That's not an analytic solution.
No, it is.
Sense that you have to do some.
They solve it to an extent that it comes down to a one variable functional equation.
Yes, so it's probably the Dyson Schmidt equation, and then you have to solve it numerically.
You can do better, you say. Well, I'd like to know. You can do better than that.
Yes.
Okay. I guess I don't understand what are you solving? Distribution of free energy?
Not the distribution, the free energy. The transition, everything you want to know about the transition, you can look at the mean chemical content, the spectral temperature, and so on. But you can also basically understand where their result from by doing the heuristics. But this time, when you look at, when you estimate the free energy for a loop, then the thing that competes is, now here I've set f equal to a constant, is not this logarithmic coming from this f, but rather from the random fluctuation of the pairing energies. So you can also estimate that. So here you have a term which is goes like the length to the power 1/2. And then you can, using the same kind of idea, to estimate the minimal loop size. And if you put in the numbers biologists use, then you come to a minimal loop size of 250 base pairs, order of magnitude. Okay? And from this length, then you would estimate the width of a transition for individual segment melting is of order of 0.1 Kelvin, which agree reasonably well with the experimental results I showed. So that's the easy case. The hard case would be that equaling both the loop entropy and the sequence heterogeneity. We did some work recently on this problem, and I think we solved the problem to some level, depending on who you are, whether you think basically solved or basically still unsolved. But of course, if you ask me, I say basically solved. But we want to put the solution in some perspective. So okay. So basically, from this, even if you fix the f equal to constant, what they are doing here is basically you are looking at the loops of a particular size. Okay. If you say I only consider loops of that size or order of that size, then this function f doesn't really vary, and then you come back to this random field eigenmodel, which people have solved. Okay. And this, in fact, applies to the whole region here around some temperature 85, which is sort of the melting temperature where you have 50-50 Cg and At. Okay. On this side, what happens is that you just start the melting process. You start to excite loops, and these loops, they have to be at least like 100 base pairs. And you're not very likely to excite loop sizes much bigger than that. Okay. So basically, even if you're sticking a constant value for the loop entropy, then you can, I think, recover this part of the curve, this melting curve, reasonably well. But when you go to the other side of the melting curve, go to higher temperatures, then you're in a very different situation. Basically, you have very large loops, but there are only a few sticking points. And you still have, and you have to treat the statistics of these sticking points accurately, and then you can explain the behavior of these melting curves really at the melting temperature, which we as physicists would define to be the temperature where the two strands become completely separated. In fact, both this region and this region. To explain the behavior, you have to use the rare event statistics. Basically, you are looking at domains of either very low GC concentration or very high GC concentration. Not the typical kind of domains, but sort of a rare event. And we actually learned a lot about how to do the rare event statistics in the past 2 or 3 weeks. And the story is that if you look at the, maybe I just focus on this transparency and then basically finish my talk. There are several curves here. It's very, very complicated transparency. There's this curve. This is the melting curve for completely random sequence. Okay. And then I have two other curves. This curve is from by taking the DNA sequence of E. coli. And then this curve from the DNA sequence of the human chromosome 22. Okay. You see that this random sequence actually has a fairly narrow transition region as compared to the real biological sequences.
Sorry, when you say random, you have imposed the correct density of
correct density. And they don't differ too much. Like the E. coli is slightly GC rich. It's about 52% CG and 48% AT. The human chromosome 22 is slightly GC deficient. It's a little bit on the other side. But the deviation you see really is due to large local fluctuations of GC and AT concentration. Okay, so coming back, so this part, basically, as I said, can be solved by the random field eigenmodel. But on this side, you have to consider the distribution of these good. So occasionally, you have a segment which is highly GC rich. Okay, and this will provide a good place for having a contact between the two strands. And you want to know the statistics of the energy gain from this kind of good contacts. It turns out that the distribution of the energy gain for the good contacts is a simple exponential distribution. And I'm just going to show you quickly an argument, and then I will quit. Why this kind of exponential statistics is so important for understanding the transition. Now, again, we look at this one loop type of argument. So suppose PR use A for good contact and B for bad contact. Okay? And occasionally you can have a string of good contacts, and this way you can gain a lot of energy by making this part in the helical form. Okay? And then between these two good places, then it's not so favorable, and then you will be in the coil state. And suppose the length of the coil state is of order L, then you have to pay a loop entropy, which is beta log. Okay. Now, how much energy you can get from this good contact? If the distribution of the energy is exponential, and then suppose it's a random sequence, then in principle, any of these places can be the good contact. Okay. So the energy gain, the best place in a very long interval of length L will also, if the distribution is exponential, will also go as log. Okay. So it's these two terms that compete each other. And then it will depend on the coefficient of the two terms. So if this exponential decay has a slow rate, which means smaller Q, then energy gain can compensate the entropic cost. Then it will still be in the bound state. But on the other hand, if Q is very large, then energy gain does not pay off the entropic cost, then you will be in the unbound state. So basically, by comparing these two coefficients, you can decide which side of the transition you will be in. And this kind of logarithmic term then gives rise to the cost of solids transition. In fact, then you can estimate the divergence of the correlation length close to the transition temperature. You can develop a full RG theory on this, but because the time is out, so I'm not telling you the details. We have a paper on this.
I'm really doubtful about your argument, because this is very similar to a problem of the wetting of a disorder, either of a
right.
or a disorder.
Right.
And then it's well known that it's not Costelli standard. I mean, just if you take which corresponds to correspond to the case beta equals, let's say, 3.5, right? In that case, it's not Costelli.
Are you sure? I mean, you're talking about the interface, the copolymer?
Yeah, but if you go in relative coordinates. No, I don't talk about the copolymer. I talk about the wetting. So you have a substrate, which is random.
Right.
And then you absorb a polymer on it.
Right.
So when you go to relative coordinates in this problem, it's exactly the same problem.
Yeah, it's exactly, well, there's a caveat. Well, in the case of when the disorder is weak, then there's, depending on the dimensionality and so on, then sometimes the disorder is irrelevant. Then you recover the exponents for the pure case. But in the case when the disorder is relevant, then I think this picture is correct.
This case corresponds to the marginal case, right? And that's a case where people haven't resolved for 10 years.
They're
sort of competing the two set of them.
Yeah, but nobody really expects a Costelli standard. So it's marginally irrelevant. The disorder is marginally irrelevant.
But that was the debate, whether it's marginally irrelevant or marginally irrelevant.
No, that's okay. Then you have weak fluctuation of the base pair binding energies. Then you can, this question is relevant, whether it's relevant or irrelevant is the thing to look at. But basically you are doing perturbation around the pure model. In fact, when the disorder is strong, I'm not aware of any good analytical method that tackle the problem without doing things you don't really know. So I think the strong disorder case, because we have all the numerical results, so that in this argument, the important thing is how does the the energy gain distributed, whether it's exponential or otherwise. And we have done a lot of numerics, and we found that indeed it is exponentially distributed. And now we also have, you know, this extreme statistics, thermal distribution, and so on. It's quite natural if you look at things from that point of view that it should be exponentially distributed. And if that's the case, then it has to be. Because you are looking at the logarithms competing each other, and then it will be the constant solids. But in fact, if you look at the real biological sequence, the contact energy scans, they actually has a fatter tail than the exponential distribution. And that will make it actually, you will probably not have a trimness until basically the point where even the best pairs are unstable. So that will be a different story.
What does that mean for solid always
relevant? Now this means if you have a fatter tail,
yes,
they can always find a good site,
yeah,
to come back,
yeah. Yeah.
And then you will never combine, yeah. So it will be no transition. So you have a tail fatter than your exponential. But of course, if you have a finite,
at some point the linear part changes.
No, this is by taking away the linear part.
Yeah,
this is your island already.
Yeah.
Okay. But occasionally you have a large fluctuation.
Yeah.
That.
But you always have a transition. But this would say that the solid is always relevant. I mean, the Castor Osiris case is a marginal.
No. No, this says you are always on the bound side. Because you can always scan.
But there is a transition. Cannot always be on the bottom.
So basically what you're saying is that as I increase the temperature further, how does this distribution change? Okay. Eventually it will become bounded somehow. Okay. And when that happens, of course, you may have a transition. But at least if the distribution continues to have this kind of tail, then you will always be on the bound side.
So there is a transition, but what are you saying about the
end of the transition? What I'm saying is that because from the melting point, and you see that if you use a real biological sequence, the transition is even broader than the random sequence. Random sequence has broadening because of this one. Okay, but in the real bio sequence, the transition is even broader because you have sort of maybe clustering of APs or CGs. You have the distribution of large segments of GC rich is far from random, and this gives rise to a broader transition. Of course, you can say eventually there will be some temperature. In fact, it will destroy the even the backbone at some point. So it becomes anyway. So. Basically, there is a regime. If you want to explain, say, if our goal is to explain the experimental melting curve,